professor walks up to me. He says, Zumbo, he says, you think you're a really big shot. He says, and this is the truth. He says, I'll bet you a case of Lucky Lager beer that you can't sell a story to Outdoor Life. Maybe you're in Africa or in Argentina or something, and there it is, and you got one opportunity for a shot. That is pressure. People would come by and try the elk, and they say, gosh, that's really good. What is that? So I say, it's elk. You can't believe how many people said, what is an elk? What is an elk? He said, didn't any of those bucks have a brow tine? So again, that just points out that you have to know what the laws are in different states. This is Jim Zumbo, and you're listening to the Wild Initiative.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
There's a lot of people that can pull the trigger on an animal, but they don't know what to do with it after.
If you would have told me that a stupid turkey was going to make me get that excited, I would have told you you were crazy.
It's just a skill that you have to perfect over a lot of years.
Hunting is a tribal activity. We've lost the tribe. We can't even hunt together anymore.
Well, the people that are anti-hunting are usually pro-abortion. So kill the people, save the animals.
I just remember riding my horse back to camp with the northern lights and the moose behind me, and I'm like, this is why I've done this. This is as cool as an experience as I will get.
Hi, this is Jim Shockey.
This is Sam Sohol, the public land bus guy.
Hi, I'm Kimmy Greentree.
Hi, this is South Cox with the Western Bowhunter Podcast.
Hey, this is Ben Dedamonte, a.k.a. Shed Crazy.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
All right, y'all. So getting on to today's episode, I have another guest of recommended by Larry Wysoon. It's been a run of just amazing people getting that I've gotten to talk to that Larry's introduced me to. Today, I have the one and only Jim Zumbo on the podcast. Y'all may remember him from some of the stories Larry told in his episode. So we'll have to give Jim a chance to turn the tables on Larry a bit. But Jim, thanks so much for hopping on with me today.
No problem, Sam. I'm glad to be here.
So one thing I always like to start out with is just a little history of you. How did you get introduced to the outdoors and hunting and fishing?
Well, basically, I was raised in upstate New York, and my family were, my grandfather, my dad and uncles were all big rabbit hunters. We take beagle hounds out and hunt bunnies, and I tagged along when I was a little kid. And so that kind of got it started. And later on, my dad was a scoutmaster, and I was a city kid, and I went out camping and hiking and stuff and continued to hunt with the family. And then I decided that at some point I want to be either a forest ranger or a game warden. And so I went to school, went to college, and up in northern New York was my first school, Paul Smith, a little two-year forestry school. And I got a degree a two-year degree in forestry. And I wrote a little column up there, a little outdoor column. One time there was a big old buck. He was called Old Joe, and he was a swamp buck. And all locals, this is right up near the Canadian border, all the locals were trying to get him. So I took off class one day with the old 30-30 and was sneaking around the marsh, and up come this big ass whitetail. I mean, he was huge, and he jumped out. I couldn't get a shot because I was squeezed under a log. But anyway, I wrote about that buck, and I turned it into the local college newspaper, and they printed it. And I thought, holy smokes, I looked at my byline 100 times. It was called Old Joe by Jim Zumbo. I thought, man, that's a big deal. So anyway, I went out west at Utah State and got into a fraternity, and they're looking for somebody to write a deer elk forecast in Utah, where we were in northern Utah. So I wrote that, and the editor says, how would you like to write an outdoor column for our newspaper called Student Life? And I thought, wow, that's a big deal. So I did. And one day we went to a Paul Bunyan party. It was just a bunch of guys. There were no women in the field in those days. We're talking 55 years ago. I'm aging myself. But anyway, we're at this party. We had a bathtub full of beer, and we were eating burgers, and it was a couple of our professors and a bunch of guys. And one professor walks up to me. He says, Zumbo, he says, you think you're a really big shot because you write that little chicken stupid article in the college paper. He says, and this is the truth. He says, I'll bet you a case of Lucky Lager beer that you can't sell a story to Outdoor Life. So, of course, I had a couple beers myself, and I said, I'll take you up on that. Long story short, I wrote a story for Outdoor Life, sent it in, and bottom line is they accepted it. So I got my case of Lucky Lager beer. But that's how it started. And I thought, man, I'm going to be a big-time writer. Well, of course, Outdoor Life's in New York City, and I didn't know any of those people. My next five or six attempts were failures. But anyway, I got lucky and was able to have a few more published, and it kind of went from there. And as far as my career goes, I worked 15 years as a forest ranger and wildlife biologist for several government agencies. And then in 1976 or 78, Outdoor Life gave me an offer to be the Western editor for the magazine. So I quit my 15-year job with Uncle Sam and went to work for Outdoor Life. And as the years went on, I became editor at large, and then I became the hunting editor, which was probably about 20 years out of my 30 with Outdoor Life. I was hunting editor. So that's basically my career.
So what advice would you have to someone, say, that's in college and has a passion for the outdoors? They love hunting, they love fishing, and maybe they want to become a writer in the outdoor industry. What advice would you have for someone like that?
Well, one of the things I'd suggest is what I didn't do. I never took a journalism course in college because I never expected to be a full-time journalist. I always thought I'd be out in the woods working. So I would suggest taking journalism and definitely, absolutely getting a degree, if possible, in natural resources. And, you know, you've got to basically have a feel for the English language and know how to write a complete sentence and have some skills that way. Seriously, I know some doctors who couldn't even write a complete sentence. So that's the key, I think, is to learn about journalism and get the degree, and then maybe start out with a small town paper as a reporter and work your way up, or get a copy of Writer's Market, which is available every year. It's revised. It's a big, huge book, and it has thousands of magazines, the names of the editors, what kind of stories they want, what they pay, and all the information you need. So you can pick and choose and see if there's something there that you have a some kind of expertise in, and try that as well. But through my life, I've met so many youngsters, well, not youngsters really, but teenagers or maybe older. So I want to do just like what you do. I want to go hunting and fishing and get paid for it. How do I do that? Well, you know, I think I was born at the right time for that. And now things are so much different. A lot of stuff is digital. A lot of the old magazines are going away. I understand Outdoor Life and Field and Stream were just sold, and I don't know what's going to happen with them. Of course, they are the two biggest outdoor magazines in the country, but things are different. But again, my dad always said, "Where there's a will, there's a way." But you've got to be able to at least write somewhat skillfully, or at least tell the story. One of the big problems is if you're going to look at a certain magazine or a market, then read the magazines and see what the editors like, what kind of stories they like, what kind they don't like. When I was Western editor, I'd have people send me stories about skydiving and kayaking. And you know, outdoor life was hunting and fishing. That stuff didn't work. And so obviously they didn't do their homework. So that's kind of my best advice.
Well, you know, I've had this topic come up a few times on the podcast, you know, and I've had people reach out to me and like, you know, okay, how do you get into the outdoor industry? And it's such a wide, vague question. And so many of them, like you said, they want to hunt and fish for a living. And what I don't think they realize is that, okay, yeah, you get to hunt and fish a lot, but you really don't hunt and fish for a living. You write for a living, or you guide for a living, or you do photography for a living. You just happen to do that while hunting and fishing, or with other hunters and anglers. And it's not like you necessarily go out and you're not getting paid to go shoot an animal. You're getting paid to write about shooting an animal.
That's exactly right. And one of the things that when I was actively writing full time, whenever I went hunting, I had to have a good camera and I had to take a lot of pictures, and that was work. I mean, that was serious work. You had to do a lot of setup stuff and before and after and the writing itself, you had to take notes, and it had to be good enough to satisfy some editor 2,000 miles away. So there was always pressure. There was always some stress involved with that. And just to kind of move forward for a second, when I started doing TV, that was a totally different dimension, because hunting is not a spectator sport, but TV made it a spectator sport. I couldn't do anything, and Larry Wysoon knows this very well, I couldn't do anything unless that cameraman was 2 feet away from me, breathing down my neck. I mean, if I turned up, he stepped on my boots, and that was not fun. Because if and a lot of times everything had to be perfect, there had to be good light, the animal had to be in focus. He had to see the animal when I did, and we might be hunting in timber, or maybe we're hunting waterfowl, and which duck or goose am I shooting at, you know? And it's just, but I think the biggest frustration was, as you probably know as an outdoorsman, that sometimes the best opportunities are early in the morning, right at shooting light. Well, that big old damn camera doesn't work at shooting light. So here you are, you know, getting ready to lower the boom on an elk or a deer, and your cameraman says, wait, I have no light. And you just want to turn around and whack him, you know, but you have to go along with the flow. But that's a little aside as far as the whole TV thing. It's different.
So tell me a little bit about your time on TV. What was the show?
Well, it was called Jim Zumbo Outdoors. It was on the Outdoor Channel. And I think I started that about 2001 and had about an 8 or 9 year run. And back in those days, the Outdoor Channel was basically the only one out there to speak of. And then the Sportsman Channel came along. But I didn't really want to do TV because, I didn't care for the fact that I had to have a cameraman with me. I'm kind of a loner. I'd like to do public land DIY hunts as much as possible. But a guy by the name of Jake Hartwick was one of the founders and the vice president of the Outdoor Channel. He said, Zumbo, I want you to come on the channel. He said, I'll take care of everything. Because I told him, I said, you know, I don't know anything about it. I don't know anything about getting sponsors or producing the damn show or editing. He says, well, we'll find you a good cameraman and we'll take care of everything. So that's kind of how it started. But most of my hunts on TV, people kind of specialize in things, but most of my hunts were in the mountains on horseback, not only right here around Cody, Wyoming, where I live, but I did a lot of stuff up in Canada and Alaska and all over the Rocky Mountains. So I'd say probably 75% of my TV content was hunting in backcountry wilderness areas. And that's what I kind of love to do. And that was the most challenging, because you had to get all that gear on horses, and, you know, you had to have batteries that were charged and all sorts of logistical problems. But that was kind of my forte.
You know, I watch those shows a lot, and everyone's a little bit different, but you know, the shows where you can tell there's a cameraman there for sure, you know, following the person around, and
right.
And you're sitting there and, you know, you've got whoever it happens to be, like belly crawling, you know, through the sagebrush with, you know, they're holding their bow and they're sneaking along. And then you're like, well, what the heck's a cameraman doing behind them? Like, how is this possibly working? And it's, or, you know, they're like posted up kind of behind a tree that's just barely covering them up. And you're thinking to yourself, like, well, I know this guy, this isn't like, you know, somebody with an eye, like, you know, people now film with iPhones and things, but like, especially some of these bigger shows, you're like, this is not some dude sitting around with an iPhone back there. How on earth is he staying concealed with this big old camera on his shoulder? And I've always been fascinated by that and impressed by the cameramen as well, because those have to be some talented, in shape dudes.
Yeah. And also there's some reenacting that's done. Like if you put a deer or elk down, you know, you go and make the recovery and the cameraman's behind you. And back in the old days, it was kind of comical because you see the deer laying on the ground and here comes a hunter approaching the deer. And you know, the cameraman's already there. He's behind the deer or elk, you know, and it just didn't make sense. But there's a lot of reenacting that's done. For example, almost always, well, most of the time, you'll see an animal go down. But just prior to that, you'll see the finger on the trigger and you'll see the safety go off. Well, that's all reenacted. That's done after the shot, you know, and it's sometimes the cameraman will ask you to actually shoot at something. So you pick out a stump or something that's safe and he'll film you taking the shot. But there's a few little things that kind of make it all go together. But, you know, some of these bigger shows, they have two cameramen. When I quit doing TV, I had two. Wherever we went, whether we went to Canada or Alaska, there's always two guys following me. And one of them would be right on me and one of them would be right on the quarry, you know. So, but it's just tough when you've got somebody else out there and you're hoping that he sees what you see and you're hoping that everything happens. And God forbid if you should wound something, because, you know, that's kind of a turn off. If you miss, that's fine. And I don't mind showing misses, you know, I've done that enough times in my life, but so there's a lot of stress. You might be in a place where you get one shot at an animal and it might cost you tens of thousands of dollars or a company to get there, you know, the travel. Maybe you're in Africa or in Argentina or something, and there it is, and you got one opportunity for a shot. That is pressure. I mean, you've got to make that shot perfectly. And that leads to another thing. People that watch TV shows, outdoor TV, hunting shows, want to see the kill. I don't care what you say. That's if you do a show or two without a kill, you will get lots of complaints. Now, because of my background in forestry and wildlife, I like to work conservation in on the hunts. And you know, like, for example, old fire areas and clear cutting will lead to more browse and better hunting. So I'll kind of get into that and talk about it. And I like to get into the outfitter's lifestyle and his family and try to tell the story. But by God, you better have a kill. Because the producers and the owners of the show would come down and say, you know what, you got to have that kill. And that's not so much the case these days, although it's almost mandatory.
I feel like in the past maybe 5 to 10 years, it's definitely, just from my experience with the hunting media I've seen, it's definitely changed and people get a lot more invested in the stories. But I think that's also because the turnover of media is like, it's constant now. There's always a new episode. There's always a new show versus some of the older stuff. You may only be getting one episode a week versus now you could get a new little mini episode every day of a hunting series.
Exactly.
And so you can have those episodes. You can have a lot more episodes without a kill or without kind of a conclusion before you get to that. And, people get invested in those stories a lot more.
Sure.
But I still think, you know, it comes down to, you want to be inspired and the experience definitely is inspiring, but you also want to see success.
Right.
You know, we have more of a tolerance, I think, for just the story at the moment, but eventually, even today, somebody wants to see an animal go down.
Sure. Now, I've done shows where I've come, well, for example, I was hunting up in the Arctic Circle for muskox and caribou. And I came back from there with three episodes, three totally different shows. And that's one thing that's kind of necessary to help on the budget, because when you make those trips like that, you want to try to get as many episodes as you can. But as you say, you know, they kind of, one leads to another, and it carries this, you know, carries the story farther. But yeah, TV has always been fun. But again, I just hated that camera guy. I'll tell you an interesting story. I was down hunting the oscillated turkey in Yucatan. And to get the world slam on turkeys, you got to have the oscillated. Well, this thing looks like a peacock. You know, it doesn't gobble. It makes this weird sound. And back in those days, you had to shoot them off the roost. Now that sounds like, oh my God, shoot a turkey off the roost. That's a cardinal sin. Well, if you didn't shoot them off the roost, you weren't going to get one. What you do is you'd follow this young man around in the woods in the dark, and he would have spotted a turkey the evening before, and he would know exactly how to get to that bird. Well, I wasn't actually following this young man. He grabbed me and said, "This way, senor," you know, so I'm following him through the jungle. He doesn't even have a shirt on. My cameraman's falling all over behind me. And all of a sudden he stops and he points up in the air at a tree, and I very vaguely see this bird up there, and it was shooting light, but it was too dark for the camera. And my cameraman's setting up. He's got the tripod, and I'm saying, "Are you ready? What you want your cameraman to say is, 'I'm on him.'"
Yeah.
When he says, "I'm on him," boom, that's what it takes. So I'm waiting for him. Can't you see him? Can't you? Come on. Isn't there enough light? Can't you do something with that damn camera to get some light? You know, and this bird's ready to pitch down. You know, he's cocking his head back and forth. And I know the guide is there. He's bewildered. Has no idea why I'm not shooting. Finally, I swear, within seconds before that bird coming down, my camera says, "I'm on him." So that was just a split second. And once they get down on the ground, you'll never see him again in the jungle. So anyway, that was crazy.
I can only imagine what that poor guide is thinking this whole time. Like, what is this crazy American doing right now? I took him right to the dang bird. Why isn't he shooting the bird?
Yeah, that's true.
Oh man, and trying to explain hunting television to some of these guys, like, you know, especially in a spot like the Yucatan or something, you know.
Yeah.
It's one thing, you know, talking to a guide say in North Dakota or something, but right. Down in the Yucatan trying to explain all of the requirements to those poor guides, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
So your passion then is kind of the big Western mountain hunts, then going in on a horseback for days at a time and chasing those big game animals.
That's right. Although when I was hunting editor for Outdoor Life, I had to write a column every month as well as feature stories and sometimes vignettes. So I needed a lot of material. So I decided one day to go on an odyssey and hunt all 50 states for deer. And at that time I had maybe 25 states. So I did. And sometimes I'd jump in my pickup truck and say bye to my wife, and I'd be gone for 3 weeks and maybe drive to Maine and hunt two or three states that were adjoining, maybe Maine and Vermont and New Hampshire, whatever, until I finally got done and I hunted them all. North Dakota was the last one because I couldn't draw a rifle tag in North Dakota, so I had to hunt with a bow. But so I did a lot of whitetail hunting, and I loved it. And I've hunted whitetails out of tree stands, and I've hunted them in Texas, you know, from blinds and stuff, But by and large, the mountain hunting was pretty much where I had concentrated my efforts. And people ask me my favorite species to hunt, and that would always be elk. I've written 7 books on elk hunting, and I can see it. In fact, I'm looking out my window right now. Honest to God, I can see elk out there. I'm looking north off to some fields. But elk has always been my all-time favorite. And mule deer as well. Of course, here in Wyoming, we've got a gazillion antelope. So that's kind of where it's at. But I do like to go to other states and hunt whitetails. For a long time, I'd go to Iowa. My old buddy, the late Tony Knight, who invented the inline muzzleloader, had a farm, and he'd invite some writer friends, and we go hunting big bucks. And I've been to Texas many, many times. Larry, Mary Burnham, Gary Robertson, who owns Burnham Brothers Calls, in a variety of other states. But when it comes right down to it, it's the mountains that I love to hunt the most.
So what is it, you know, because I'm the same way. I love, I love elk. I'm obsessed with them. I think they're the most amazing creatures on earth, and I enjoy hunting mule deer. I've been building points for pronghorn in Wyoming. So I've yet to get to hunt pronghorn, but
we'll have to change that, Sam. Seriously. Next year we'll get you down here and hunt pronghorn.
Sounds good. I should have a decent amount of points, decent amount of points by then. So,
yeah.
So let's see what I can draw for next year. That'd be amazing.
That's a promise. And I just made it public to all of your listeners. So there we go.
I better get this podcast released quick, man. Get it out there.
Yeah. You bet.
But so what for you, what is it about elk? Because I feel really the same way. I think they're the most amazing creatures on earth, and I'm obsessed with them. And so I always love to hear, because everybody's reasons are so different.
Well, you know, I think as far as elk go, when I first started hunting elk, I was living in Utah, and this is back in the 60s when there were not a lot of elk, and most of them were on private ranches. And I hunted for 6 years with my buddies and hunting BLM, Bureau of Land Management land, and were with a zillion other hunters before I even saw a legal bull, 6 years. And I got to the point where I was so challenged. I said to myself, well, one day I'm going to learn everything I can about these animals, you know, and hunt them as much as I can. So I did. And to answer your question, what I love about them most is, number one, they live in the most spectacular country in the West. You know, they live in the yellow aspens and the timber, and some of them live out in the sagebrush, but they're big. A big bull will weigh 650, 700 pounds body weight, and they're beautiful. The color of them, the antlers are spectacular, and of course the ability to vocalize with them, the communication by bugling and using cow calls, and just the whole essence of hunting elk in the mountains is, to me, has always been a great big turn on. I got to the point where, and I was doing TV and with Outdoor Life, right, hunt elk in 3 or 4 states a year, and also Canada. There was a place up in British Columbia where I go pretty much every year. But then again, on the table, my wife won't eat beef anymore. I'm nothing as beef. You know, we go to a restaurant, I'll have a steak, but she's got to have elk. She won't eat beef. She's gotten to the point where, and that's our all-time favorite for eating. So that plus all of the other reasons I mentioned is one of the reasons why I like elk so much. They're just amazing animals.
You know, I finally got my first elk this year down in Arizona. And,
good for you.
I've been trying. Thank you. I've been trying for 4 years, and finally, you know, with the help of my buddy who took me out, he guided me. I got my first elk, and it's been amazing. Like having that in the freezer, and because I've gotten a couple of deer before, it's always been smaller. So I've been a bit more reserved with my usage of the meat.
Right.
You know, I feel like I'll save it for something bigger and more special.
Sure.
Than just kind of like everyday eating. But having this elk and having that full freezer,
yeah,
it's just nice to be. I mean, and it's, you would never guess, like your average person would never guess any difference. Mm-hmm. Really, if you never told them, I grilled up a big old elk round steak when I went back to California to pick up all my stuff and move out to Montana. I brought back some elk with me and grilled up just a big old elk round steak, you know, used a rub, I did this thing up really just incredibly. It was fantastic. And you would have never guessed, like it was just as rich. And I mean, I liked it better personally because it was lean, you know, you didn't have to, you know, you weren't sitting there trying to pick through the big veins of fat and everything, but it was still flavorful and just juicy.
Exactly.
Oh, gosh, I'm like drooling right now thinking about it. It's getting close to lunch.
I like to process my own, and I've got a room. I've got one of the big grinders, and I've got a mixing thing where I can mix the meat in the suet or whatever, and I make my own sausage and burger and cut everything up myself. And to me, that's a big part of it. I have a lot of fun doing that. And I've cut up stuff in that room from doves to moose. And it's just a challenge. And I know what meat it is. You know, of course it's organic, which everybody makes a big deal about these days. They're out there in the wild and they're not eating any pesticides or fertilizers or whatever, steroids. But I think that elk are, I can't describe it. It's just, and you know what I mean too.
Oh yeah.
It's just, they're just amazing critters.
Well, I always, you know, and I've said this a few times on the podcast before, it's like, imagine, you know, you run into someone in the city that has literally zero experience with the outdoors. I mean, they haven't watched a show, nothing. They barely know what a deer is. Imagine then if you just sat down and you tried to fully describe an elk to this person, they would think you had lost your mind. Like, these are ridiculous. And I'd be like, okay, well, it's like, it's kind of built like a cow, but it's the size of a horse. And they've got these giant antlers that are like 4 or 5 feet long. And they make this screaming noise and squeaking noises and this and that to communicate. And they taste fantastic. They'd be looking at you like you had lost your ever loving mind.
You're
and
right.
I think we take it for granted that these are creatures straight out of a fantasy novel. They're amazing.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that. Years ago, when I was doing television, I used to go to a cable show every year. And the cable shows are either in New Orleans or in Los Angeles. And you never know who you'd see. These were giant shows. The booths were huge. HBO would be there in Disneyland. And you might walk into Sylvester Stallone or you just, I mean, this was, and most of the people were walking around with 3-piece suits, right? They were all city folks, all of them in production and TV of some sort. And I was there with the Outdoor Channel, and I had a little 2-burner stove, and I was cooking stuff, cooking elk and salmon, and I would give out samples. Well, most of the booths gave away free stuff. So what the free stuff that we gave away was my elk. Well, in the meantime, I had the venue chefs cook up huge amounts of this elk, according to my recipe, and bring it out in these great big giant dishes. People would come by and try the elk, and they say, gosh, that's really good. What is that? So I say, it's elk. You can't believe how many people said, what is an elk? Just yep. Like you said, what is an elk? And so I try to tell them, and people say, well, where can I get an elk? And I'd say, do you know any hunters? And most of them would say, no. Now, we're talking L.A., right?
Yeah.
And I'd say, well, the next best is you can buy elk. You can actually, you know, buy elk that are raised on elk farms, and they're raised for that reason. And I told them, well, you might be paying $20 a pound, you know, they're so at any rate, I try to explain to folks what elk were. And I wish I had a video set up so I could show them pictures of bulls bugling and whatever. But at any rate, you're right. It's tough for people to comprehend. I've seen some city hunters. I've been there on a couple of occasions. When we were in the backcountry, I had a guy one time pass up a giant mule deer, and he had a tag I already gotten my deer. It was an outfitter. He was on a horse behind us, and I told the guy, get off your horse and shoot that deer. And he sat on his horse, and I said, get off your damn horse and shoot that buck. And he still didn't get off. Well, I got off my horse, and I grabbed a hold of his rein and said, please shoot that buck. He said, that's not a deer, that's an elk. I couldn't, and all of a sudden, here come the outfitter around the bend, mad as hell. He says, what the hell happened? Why didn't you shoot that giant buck? And the guy was mortified. But I've seen other folks that, I'm getting off the subject here, but actually seen folk. And, you know, in moose country, I hate to say this, but some people will actually shoot a moose and think they're an elk. And you'll see signs. This is a moose. It makes it look stupid, right? This is what a moose looks like, but people see an animal coming through the timber and they see those dark legs and they don't know that it's not an elk and they might shoot it. So at any rate, that's just a little aside from what you said.
Oh no. And I mean, to some extent I get it. You know, I'm a studier and I've always been a studier. And so I've, you know, the past 4 years that I've been hunting, I spend every spare moment I have looking at these animals, watching videos. I've got, you know, whether it's on Netflix or Amazon Prime or just on YouTube or whatever, I've always got some sort of film playing. And so I feel like I've been pretty educated on what they look like, you know,
sure.
Whether it's bulls or cows or does or bucks, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, exactly. And you can't blame a person who hasn't hunted. You know, I had a guy here this summer. We were out and it was a bunch of antelope out there. He said, look at those deer. Well, he was not an outdoorsman. He was a city guy and he didn't know, you know. So, like you say, you have to study and know what's what.
And, you know, I'd almost have more, a little bit of added respect for that guy that was on the horseback, you know, with you and the outfitter, because he didn't take that shot. You know, it was kind of dumb that he thought it was an elk and it was actually a mule deer or whatever.
Yeah.
But I almost have a little bit of added respect for him that even with, you know, you being like, shoot the damn deer, that he stuck by his guns, even though his guns were wrong. Like it takes a lot of integrity to be able to do that when you got someone sitting there pressuring you, like, shoot it, shoot it, shoot it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe if the outfitter said shoot it, he would have shot it. He didn't know who I was. I didn't know who he was, you know.
Yeah.
I went along for the heck of it. But that was one of the biggest bucks I ever seen in my life. That was over in the Grays River country in western Wyoming, which is known for big deer.
But, you know, then all of that being said, it is our responsibility. It doesn't matter how new you are to the outdoors. It is our responsibility to educate ourselves and to be ethical. And, you know, again, I understand somebody that's new to this confusing maybe a cow elk for a cow moose. And I could understand it, but there's no excuse for shooting that animal.
That's exactly right.
If you're going to be out in the woods, you need to be educated, and
you do. And you need to read. You need to read the regulations. Really read the. I'll tell you an interesting story. One time, I was living in Utah, I had drawn a Wyoming buck tag, which was pretty close to the border. I live near Flaming Gorge in Vernal, close to Wyoming. So I drawn this Wyoming tag. In Wyoming, a deer had to have 4 points to be legal in that particular unit. So I was up there with my son on opening day. Here come three big bucks boiling over this ridge. And we were in the sagebrush. We stayed quiet and they started feeding right in front of us, maybe 80 yards away, 90 yards away. And I looked at them and every one of them was a 3 point, every one of them. And it had to be a 4 point to be legal. And I'm telling my son, I'm whispering, God, I don't see a fourth point in any one of those. Do you? And he says, no, Dad, I don't. So I mean, we're sitting there with binoculars for 10 minutes and we could not get a fourth point on any buck. Well, anyways, they drifted off and went back to the truck to have lunch. Game warden comes by, Wyoming game warden. He says, how'd you do? And I says, we saw some really nice bucks, but they weren't legal. He said, they weren't. He says, what were they? I said, they were all 3 points. He said, didn't any of those bucks have a brow tine? I said, well, yeah. He said, well, in Wyoming, a brow tine counts. You were looking at four pointers. In Utah, a brow tine does not count. You have to count the 4 points on the forks. So, again, that just points out that you have to know what the laws are in different states. So, again, in Montana, where you live, for example, you've got a – what's your Hunter Orange law? You probably have to have a hat and a vest.
There's a certain amount like of – it's, you know, and somebody's going to correct me. It's something like 50 square. There has to be a certain amount of square inches. I can't remember if it's required for you to have a hat or if it's just the.
Well, again, every state has a law. I can tell you that Colorado requires 500 square inches. And that you have to wear a hat. And that hat cannot be a camo hat. It's got to be a solid orange hat. Plus your vest or your jacket has to make up the rest of it. In Wyoming, only a hat is required. So you only need to have an orange hat. So again, every state has a different law. And it's incumbent on us as hunters to know those laws. You know, sometimes game wardens take a dim view if you're ignorant and really don't know. Sometimes even blatant laws are broken because people are careless. So it's you gotta be responsible when you're out there. I've heard people say that if you hunt enough, you're eventually gonna break a law. You know, inadvertently, not intentionally, but maybe something you screwed up on, didn't read close enough. So that's always part of it.
And, you know, it's not a fun thing. Like sitting there scanning the regulations is not like, you know, when we think about prepping for your hunt, you know, you don't want to sit and read the, you know, the whatever few pages and sort through it. And but it's so important. And even for reasons that are beneficial to you outside of just not breaking the law, but like you said, you could have shot any of those or several of those deer probably, but you didn't even realize it. And
yeah, I didn't know the law.
There was, I was hunting Montana last year. I had an elk and a mule deer tag. And in Montana on the general tag, it differs from unit to unit, whether you can shoot a whitetail or a mule deer, a doe or a buck. And it's completely different in just about every single unit.
True.
And so there was a lot of times where, you know, I'd go to a new unit and I'd hop over to this new unit and I would forget to double check the regs before going out just because I'm switching, I'm moving, I'm thinking, you know, I'm moving fast. And I was mostly chasing elk. Deer was kind of secondary. But I'd forget to check those regulations and I would see a mule deer or a whitetail, and I'd sit there and I'd have just a moment, plenty of time to have wet, you know, I was there for bow and archery and rifle season. So, you know, whether it was pull back my bow or pull up my rifle, I had plenty of time for that.
Right.
What I didn't have time was to pull up my phone, pull up my Onyx, double or whatever it was, yeah, double check the regulations. Oh crap. Can I shoot a whitetail buck in this unit? Oh, I hope so. Oh crap. And then by that time, the thing's like, what's this idiot standing around for and is gone.
Yeah. But,
you know,
exactly right.
It's not just important for staying out of trouble. It's important for having the most successful hunt you can have.
Yep, exactly. What I do is I apply for multiple tags here in Wyoming, and here you can actually shoot three elk, one bull and two cows, and a buck antelope and four does, and a buck deer and four does. So I apply for multiple tags. This year I got seven tags. So I on a little piece of paper, I'll write down the species, the unit, and the season dates, and I'll actually glue that on the dash of my pickup truck so I can refer to it. Now, some of them, one whitetail doe tag had to be shot within a quarter of a mile of an irrigated field. Now, that's a depredation hunt. So I want to make sure I know what the hell tag I'm putting on that doe, because otherwise you could be in big trouble if the game warden comes along. And like you say, the OnX thing works only if which is a fabulous app. Everybody I know uses it. It only works if you use it correctly, you know, and you pay attention to the boundaries. As you know, every unit has a different boundary. It's a little confusing here in Wyoming. I don't know what it's like in Montana, but here a boundary can be a hydrological divide. Okay, maybe unit 18 is west of that divide and maybe unit 19 is east of that divide. Well, a hydrological divide doesn't mean a stream or a creek. It's just kind of a maybe a little draw in some hills, and you have no damn idea where in the world that hydrological divide is. So the Onyx thing will tell you, and that's a great, great asset to have when you're hunting.
Oh yeah. And you know, it's just, it comes down to, we just need to be as educated as possible, and it's not always fun. It's not the cool stuff that you want to sit and post about on Instagram or,
right. Yeah,
or whatever it is, you know?
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, other than necessarily being, well, I mean, even more so than being proficient with your weapon, the most important thing to your hunt is being educated and legal. Because if you're not legal, it doesn't matter how proficient you are with that weapon.
Yep.
You know, you are not an ethical hunter at that point.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yep. And that, speaking of being proficient with your weapon, you know, that brings up another point. A lot of guys, especially non-residents, will come out here and they'll zero their rifle in at home, whether they're in Ohio or Pennsylvania or Georgia, and they call it good at 100 yards. You know, okay, I got a nice little grouping at 100 yards, so I'm going out to Colorado or Montana and I'm going to go hunt an elk or a deer. Well, they get out here, and there's an antelope out there 350 yards away. I have no idea what that bullet's doing. They know what it's doing at 100 yards. So obviously the suggestion is to understand the ranges. And I'm talking about conventional guns. Nowadays, you know, we got the long range stuff that'll kill stuff out at 1,000 or more yards, but just with conventional rifles. So it behooves a hunter to get very familiar with that rifle and understand what that bullet's doing out there. past 150, 200 yards. And a way to do that, as you know, there's so much land in Montana and the West Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service. Once you get on public land, you can get out of your truck and set up and set a target up at 300 yards and see what's going on and just know. So that's always important.
Now, you know, and that was something I talked with recently, just talked with Tim Fallon about.
Yeah.
You know, he runs the SAM Hunter training program, and
yeah,
and he's very focused on, okay, yeah, it's one thing to be able to shoot out to 1,000 yards. Is that effective in a hunting scenario? Is it ethical in a hunting scenario?
Right.
Probably not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's so many challenges. There's so many challenges to long range shooting. I mean, you have got to have, first of all, you got to have a rifle and a scope that are up to the task, and they're not cheap. You know, they're fairly spendy, but you're shooting at an animal 1,000 yards or more away. You had better know what the wind is doing. It may not be blowing where you're shooting from as much as it is or less out there where that elk or deer is at 1,000 yards away. And there's a lot of variables, and lots of folks think it's ethical and fine. And, you know, everybody's got their own choice. Some guys hunt with a stick bow, you know, they hunt with a long bow, and some hunt with an old flintlock. It all depends on, you know, on what you like to do and what you perceive as the way you like to hunt.
So changing gears a little bit here, I talked with Larry, and as I mentioned earlier, he kind of threw you under the bus a little bit with a couple of stories.
I can't. Just a couple?
So, you know, after he explained, you know, well, one, I would love for you to give your side of the story, because as he tells it, they dropped you off to a turkey spot, I believe, or I can't remember if it was a turkey spot or a tree stand for deer. But they came back an hour later, and you were still tangled up in a barbed wire fence, hadn't moved.
Ah. Actually, I was hunting on a ranch in Texas with Larry. We were hunting turkeys, and we were fishing for gar in this canal. And I decided to go off and look for a turkey. So I left the group, and I had barely gotten 150 or 200 yards away when there was a fence. And I decided to go under it rather than over it. So I'm wiggling under the fence, and I've got a backpack on. And I realized as I get almost halfway through that I am stuck. Now, I'm really stuck. I can't wiggle forward or backward. If I yelled loud enough, they would have heard me, but I would have never heard the end of it. So I just worked my way out of there. It might have taken me another 20 minutes, but I finally got out and went turkey hunting. And I made a big mistake, damn it, when I got back to tell them what happened. And you don't want to ever do that with Larry Wysoon, because they'll never let you forget it. I'll tell you a funny story. A couple of years ago, we were out at Port Mansfield fishing offshore. And we're out in a boat, a bunch of us, and we were catching some small tuna and whatever. And it was my turn in the chair, and a blue marlin hit. Holy smokes, he come out of the water, and I'm trying to be a good guy and pass a rod off to somebody that, you know, hadn't caught a blue marlin before. All of a sudden, Larry reaches out with that great big giant hand of his, and he says, I'll take that damn rod. I said, okay, have at it. So he jumps in the chair, and he caught the blue marlin, which was fun. We had a ball. We have another buddy, I don't know if Larry told you, Rick Lambert. Rick is Miranda Lambert's dad.
Okay.
And everybody knows Miranda Lambert's probably the top female vocalist nowadays. She's won all the awards, but Rick is a great guy. He's a fanatical hunter and fisherman, and he and I and Larry call ourselves the three amigos. And we've been on a heck of a lot of hunts together up here in Wyoming, different places in Texas, Oklahoma. But it's always fun to get together with him. And Larry is often called the nicest guy anyone's ever met. That guy actually tips his hat to a woman when he meets a lady. I've never seen anybody do that before.
I tell you what, it's, you know, I think it disappeared with it. You know, we're all wearing, so many of us are wearing ball caps now. It kind of disappeared with the ball cap. It's
right.
You need to start bringing that back, either that or wear cowboy hats more often.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, as we're kind of winding down here, one of the things I always like to finish up with is, say you run into someone and, you know, maybe it's after a hunt or just someone that knows you're a hunter, and you're talking with them and they're like, you know, I always loved the idea of hunting. You know, it sounded so interesting, but I don't have any friends or family that do it. I don't know anyone. I don't have any experience. And it all seems a little bit intimidating. There's way too much to learn. I don't think I can do it. See, what advice or insight would you give to that person?
Well, you know, typically I would tell them, if there is a Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation or a Ducks Unlimited or a Mule Deer Foundation banquet in town, a get together to join those and kind of mingle with other hunters, you know, and try to meet some folks. But you're right. It's tough. I've known some guys and women, you know, lots of women are hunting nowadays. In fact, that's the biggest growth in hunting is females. But most of us had a mentor, you know, whether it was your dad or your best friend or your brother, or your grandpa, someone that took us out and learned us a rope. But some people wake up in the morning and they'll say, by golly, I want to start hunting. I'm talking about someone who might even be in middle age. And that's tough. But I think that that trying to meet hunters at different social functions or whatever and join some of these outfits and try to get acquainted is, and again, it's not easy to do sometimes, but I think that would be my best advice.
Well, Jim, I appreciate you taking the time today to hop on and tell your story a little bit. If people wanted to follow along or reach out, where could they find you online?
Okay, you can go to jimzumbo.com, and that'll take you to my website. And if you click on the top, explore Jim's blog, I write a blog that's available to the public. Anybody can see it. All you have to do is click on it. That's free. And you can read some of the stuff I'm writing. Other than that, the only platform I use is Facebook. And I know nothing about Twitter. And I understand now there's a new deal called Parler and MeWe, and I have no damn idea what they are, and I have no intention in learning. So basically, you can look at my blog. And oh, I also write, how can I forget this? I write the back page for Peterson's Hunting Magazine, which is a old respected magazine. It comes out of, I'm not sure where it's produced, I guess California, but it's about 45 years old. And I write the back page. It's called Rear View. So all you have to do is turn the back cover, and there's my column. And it's just a one pager, and it's about whatever I want to write about that month. So that's one way to connect.
There we go. Well, I will make sure to link to that on the show notes page for this episode. Jim, thank you so much for taking the time.
And don't forget what I said about an antelope hunt. Now, you guys got a lot of antelope up there in Montana, but if you want to put in for Wyoming, we got some good hunting right around here in Cody.
Oh, I will definitely be talking to you more about that.
Okay, great, Sam. Good luck to you, buddy.
Thank you. All right, y'all, that'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com/175 to get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. That'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this podcast inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher, and head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from the Wild Initiative family, and more.